Welcome to PlayThink, conversations about games, interactivity, art, and culture. This podcast is recorded live at the USC Game Innovation Lab, which is part of the USC Games program at the University of Southern California. For more information, follow us on Instagram at USC Game Innovation Lab or visit our website at gameinnovationlab.com/playthink.
Hello everyone here in person, and a big hello to our listeners tuning in online. Welcome to PlayThink Salon, where we dive deep into the worlds of game, art, culture, and interactivity. I'm Dr. Matthew Kupelton, a Sustainability Solutions Postdoctoral Fellow in the USC Interactive Media and Game Design Program, and I'm honored to be hosting this episode today. Today I'll be having a conversation with my colleague, mentor, and advisor, Dr. Treyandrea Russwurm.
It's good to be here.
Dr. Russwurm is a professor in the Interactive Media and Games Division at the University of Southern California and a series editor of Power Play, Games, Politics, Culture from Duke University Press. She teaches courses on video games, digital culture, and popular media like film, television, and streaming platforms. Professor Russwurm is the director of the Radical Play Game Design Lab, a community-engaged research and game design lab here at USC that focuses on centering the creativity and diverse perspectives of people from historically marginalized groups. The lab connects USC students, industry professionals, community leaders, and high school students who are committed to radically changing the games and play landscape. I'm collaborating with Dr. Russwurm and colleagues at the lab to design and study climate justice learning activities featuring games and game design. Professor Russwurm is also an editor, associate editor for Outreach and Equity for the Journal of Cinema and Media Studies, and she's appeared in popular media venues like CNN. A prolific writer and editor on film, television, games, and other media, Professor Russwurm has published widely, including the books Gaming Representation, Race, Gender, and Sexuality in Video Games, Blackness is Burning, Civil Rights, Popular Culture, and the Problem of Recognition, and From Media to Media Mogul, The Arising Tyler Perry. She's currently working on three new books on race and gaming cultures, including a book on The Sims. And since Professor Russwurm and I are collaborating closely on several projects, today's PlayThink format will be more of a conversation between us rather than an interview. We'll be discussing how games shape civic engagement, power structures, and democracy. We'll dive into the ways that interactive media can challenge or reinforce social hierarchies and inspire new forms of play. So let's begin.
Awesome. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let's jump right in really to the heart of the matter. Let's get right into it here. So our communities, as we all know, our communities are facing many challenges today, from extreme racism to extreme weather events, fires, climate change, and so on. In this context, why should we play? Why should we design games?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question. We're jumping right into the big topics, right? this is a sort of big philosophical. It could be a big sort of philosophical question, but I also think it's just a personal question. And I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir here at USC Games because I think that anything I'm about to say about why play is important, I'm going to have, you know, a good audience that's receptive to these thoughts. But why should we play at times like this? I mean, I think we should always play. I think of games as a subset of play. You can play in lots of different ways, right? You can play while you cook. You can play at gardening. You can play in just about, you know, most things in life. And games are definitely a function of play. The quickest answer that I have for that, and I'd love to hear what you think as well, you know, because again, this is a conversation, and I'm sure we're going to build on, you know, what each other is saying, is I keep hearing in my head, you know, play is liberation. Play is definitely related to being free in some ways. Not always. There's I can put some qualifications, you know, depending on what you're playing at or how you're playing or what the context is. But the reason I think of play as connected to liberation is because of its role in broadening the imagination. No matter what you're in, play is speculative, right? You have to imagine, if I make this move, then that will happen. Or if I make this move, then that's gonna happen. You're already thinking 2-3 steps, moves or actions ahead in order to play at something, even if you're playing at cooking, right? If I add this spice or this ingredient, you know, I'm way off road here now, I'm making brownies, but this is what I'm doing, you know, I'm adding some bananas or whatever. You're already trying to imagine what's gonna happen next. So it's predicated on these what if scenarios that you're constantly teasing out and playing out. And I think that's liberating. I think that any liberation worth having is going to require speculative, like action-based, imaginative thinking. And for me, play is about freeing up that engine, freeing up and activating that process of being able to move through the world in a freer way and solve problems, solve real problems. And I think it's probably, for a lot of people, counterintuitive, you know, that play can get you there. But in reality, I think it's absolutely essential. Yeah, what do you think?
I definitely agree with that. Yeah, that what if, that speculative thinking, you know, somebody might be thinking, if I make this move, what happens? And then in real life, they might be thinking, you know, if we take action and say, go protest, what might happen, right? So, you know, I imagine, like, for example, a lot of the young people that are engaged in walkouts against deportations right now, you know, they might be playing on their phones or their consoles or computers, right? And they're asking, what next? And then the next day at school, they're asking, well, what happens next when everybody walks out, right? I'm also thinking about what Bernie DeKoven said about how play can be co-liberating, that experience when you're playing well, where you're in a state with somebody where you're really seeing each other, right? Mm-hmm. You're really paying attention to what other people, how other people are playing with you. You're consenting. Everyone's consenting actively, right? To playing well together. That process of sort of figuring out what that looks like together can also be a form of building trust, which can build the kind of community needed to actually take action for social change, right? And that experience is so precious. And when I experience that moment, you know, playing with friends or, you know, or family or colleagues, you know, it's very, that gives me confidence to keep going in efforts for social change. Also, there's so much research from the learning sciences, which is one of the fields I'm connected to, right, that says that play is a space, games are a space where people can practice high-stakes skills in lower-stakes settings. Mm-hmm. Where we can make mistakes and we can learn from those mistakes. And, you know, I've been an activist for about 20 years, right? And often we don't have a lot of room for error when we're doing community organizing. The stakes are very, very high. They're higher now than ever. So we need spaces to practice, and the kinds of games that we design with our lab and, you know, that many of you here might design or listeners might design could provide those spaces to practice the skills we need to make these futures happen. Yeah.
And I just want to add a qualifier for me to that part of the conversation, because I agree with everything you said. It makes me think of, does the context matter, right? Mm-hmm. Does what you're playing matter for doing some of this, right? For building trust and cooperation, for practicing, for doing some of the problem solving we would like to see happen. And I think my answer is both and, right? It's that the context does matter sometimes. Mm-hmm. What kind of game are you playing? Are you playing a serious game? Are you playing a game that was sort of designed with some of these goals in mind? Or are you playing something else? The Grand Theft Auto, for example, or Call of Duty. I always think of Call of Duty as an example, and I feel like I pick on that franchise, but could you be playing Call of Duty and also doing the kinds of work from a cooperation, community building standpoint, from that just being in that space of liberation? Could you play this, you know, imperialist? Could you play this game or that game or Grand Theft Auto and activate some of these same things? And I'm inclined to say yes. I mean, I don't think that always happens, right? I don't think that every play session of Call of Duty gets you there, or every play session progression of Grand Theft Auto gets you there, but I'm really open to the surprising moments, unscripted moments, when some of that still happens anyhow. You know, and I've seen it in my research on like fan communities, like Black fan communities, for example, playing whatever game they're playing. I think you meet people where they are, and hearing the dialogue, the discourse that can happen in a space where you're like, oh, I'm just gonna go like steal this car right now. You're in Grand Theft Auto, you know, we're joyriding and we're doing this, but then real conversation is happening and you're talking about, I remember I wrote about the different types of protests that happen in games and during some protests after Ferguson, for example, a bunch of Black males were playing Grand Theft Auto and having real, like, serious conversations. And they were doing regular Grand Theft Auto actions, you know, of like, let's take this car, let's drive up to here, let's parachute off of that. But it was the discourse that pushed that play space into something else. So, yeah, and even when you're not doing that, like, type of, like, literal coalition building and strategizing, I think that sometimes those play sessions are still valuable. I say it as a qualifier because I don't know that it always happens. And I think that the context in the games can matter, too, and that sometimes they further an agenda that is antithetical to the type of work that we're hoping for. But I like to leave that door open for the surprise factor and the possibility that real interesting creative work can happen in all kinds of spaces.
I agree with that. I never want to underestimate what people can do to take these media forms and make them their own, right? Mm-hmm. And experience these sorts of things. Moving on to another question here. You edited an upcoming book called Anti-Racist Futures, and I contributed a chapter on a game I'm about to release called Kai Unearthed, a meditation on unpoliced futures. Let's discuss how games can support the creation of anti-racist futures.
Well, first, congratulations on the release of Kai Unearthed, which is coming soon,
thank you,
right?
Thank you. April 4th.
Is it next week? April 4th?
April 4th,
I don't know what
on
week
Steam.
It is. Yeah. This might be next week. So maybe by the time this is out, it'll be live and people can play it. And so before I answer that question, I'd like you to talk about Kai Unearthed. I mean, this is an opportunity to hear more, and then, you know, maybe my answer is going to be related to this. So.
Okay. Thank you. So Kai Unearthed is a meditation on unpoliced futures. We started working on it, actually inspired by young people when I was a high school teacher, young people who were organizing to stop youth incarceration in Seattle. To shut down a youth jail that was, like, literally toxic and also figuratively. It had a long track record of racist practices and so on. So we started to imagine what could replace this facility, what kind of unpoliced future could exist. And it's a future healing from climate change, where fossil fuels have also been abolished, where people become wild tenders, people who heal the relationship between humans and non-humans. Young people go through a coming-of-age ritual to become wild tenders. And in that ritual, they reflect back on their ancestors, who could be any of us, and the actions we did or did not take to make such a world possible. So you play as possibly one of your descendants, encountering you as an ancestor, go through scavenger hunts and branching narrative storylines, and it's a visual novel, a sort of a young adult visual novel. And it comes with an analog journal that you can do meditation practices and reflection with. So it definitely relates to the themes of your
absolutely.
Book more broadly. Other folks have contributed as well.
Yeah, so I should say about the book, Anti-Racist Futures, it is academic publishing has a very long tail. So I can't say, I think it's supposed to come out in 2026 in the fall. So what is it, next year? Yeah, next year, next fall, I think it's supposed to come out. So it feels far away, but
we'll have you back.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I co-edited with Soraya Murray, who is at UC Santa Cruz, and you know, I said it's going to come out maybe next year, but we've been working on it for a long time. You know, and whenever you do a collection like this, where you get a lot of voices, a lot of designers, a lot of game studies folks and scholars, it's a lot to manage. There's a lot of moving parts. And I've always published several edited collections, and they've always been relatively fast. This is the one time where it's not, you know, where it's like people say, hey, you're dealing with a lot of moving parts and a lot of people. So it's going to usually, you're going to hit some snags and roadblocks. I've never had that happen. But with this book, we've had about every delay that you could have. And I think it's fine because it's going to be timely and important whenever it comes out. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we asked game designers to kind of meditate on some of the key terms like anti-racism, speculative game design, and what does the future have to do, what can games tell us about the futures we're creating or headed toward, and how can we use games to intervene in some of that. And so we got just amazing content, amazing chapters and reflections from people who run labs, people who have made games recently, like yourself, also from traditional academics and scholars. So we have an opening section that is a bunch of key terms. And so it's thinking about terms like play, like we're talking about now, and how does that relate? How can that term be rethought in the context of anti-racism, for example? Other terms like speculative, right? Are all games speculative? Do we think that they're all doing this kind of work? Do they all have this potential? And so power is another term, ideology. So we kind of started out the book with a kind of grammar or vocabulary for how can you do this work? What are some of the heady concepts and terms that we're familiar with from our kind of discussions of games and game history? And then it moves into essays and interviews. And so we alternated between kind of traditional structured academic essays. Muriel Tramis, who we were fortunate to have last month at USC Games, she's credited and celebrated as first Black woman game designer. There's a lot on her in the book, and even though she's from sort of like an earlier moment in the history of games, she comes up in conversations about the future, right? Because obviously there's a tie-in between where we've been and how we understand history and what the future can be. So I think there's three chapters on her games and sort of rethinking her work, which is going to be really great to see that out there. But there's just there are a lot of different approaches to this question, and I can't say, and sometimes there are tensions too in the collection, you know, where there isn't always agreement. We've got a good section on like indigeneity in games, for example, and there's a lot of tension, productive, like generative tension about sort of reading and understanding representations of indigeneity in games, but also thinking about the space of like indigenous game design and what is that and what can that be? And our authors, you know, I think it's productive when they don't agree. And it's our job as editors to frame that conversation, I think, in productive ways, which is what we try to do. So I'm looking forward to that book being out and done and, you know, past all the stages of academic publishing. So soon, coming soon next year, late next year. Yeah.
Definitely looking forward to the conversations that will facilitate. So changing lanes a little bit here. So in the Radical Play Lab, mm-hmm. we're building community-based game design ecosystems. Mm-hmm. That's how we talk about our work together, right? So let's talk about why we're doing that and how that's going. In particular, we can talk about this question: how can this kind of community-based game design encourage civic engagement, social change, liberation?
Right. Yeah. So I want to say, for those people who don't know about Radical Play, it's a lab here, community-centered game design lab, and community outreach and engagement game design lab at USC. It is also a lab that I started before coming to USC, so it had a different lifespan when I was on the East Coast at UMass Amherst, and it's taken its own a new shape here at USC because of working with so many designers. But before I came here, it didn't have the design component. It was more about working with high school students, and you always, you know, have lots of kids who play games, and mostly those kids don't see themselves as potentially either taking that hobby seriously or making games at some point in their life. So it was more like a self-awareness, kind of career exploration type of lab in its prior lifespan. And now here at USC, we're actually working with high schools again. And in some cases, junior high school. We're working with junior high school students and high school students next week at an all-girls like leadership academy. And so now it does involve more kind of tools for making games and a couple of modules on like character design and talking about social issues and how can you make community-centered or community-focused games. And then your work that you brought to the lab, you know, I have to say, has been instrumental in the lab even existing here, you know, because I had a vision of a very slow rollout, get my bearings, you know, be at USC, do a couple of new classes and things, and then kind of get around to bringing the lab here and building a community. But you being here accelerated a lot of that, and I thank you for your energy and time and the work that you've done, particularly with the local high school and doing teaching, you know, on site there and research and helping train a lot of our younger lab members, team members. So it's been really great to see you take the lead on all of those things and build the lab, you know, into the lab community, into some of your research. So I don't remember what the question was, but I would answer why is this work important to me, or what is the kind of stuff that we do in the lab? I think I've spoken to that a little. But my passion for doing that work really rests with, again, working with communities that may not see themselves in the game space and also may not have a lot of contact with USC and USC as a community resource. And so to be able to build relationships within our community, within a 2 to 3 to 4 mile radius of this campus, has been really enriching. And to see students here on campus and host them, and then to go to those schools and again, help take seriously their passion and love for games, but also see it transform into something community centered and based in advocacy, based in like community centered advocacy as well, when they come up with ideas, build around ideas that reverberate back to their community. So then seeing games as a way to foster community action. Yeah, so I don't know, for you, what's your experience been like in this short period of time helping build the lab?
There's so much I could say on this. I want to highlight something that actually links back to PlayThink. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, I'm working with a local high school here in South Central LA. We were invited by teachers there to co-teach a game design class there, which emphasizes environmental justice and climate justice themes. So we're supporting students in making their own games about, for example, extreme weather conditions, heat waves, and so on in South Central LA, drawing from their own experiences, their own cultural wealth, their own analyses, their own strategies for social change, and so on. And so the link to PlayThink is that I remember watching, I was in the audience like many of you, many years ago, when Tracy was hosting Bo Ruberg for a PlayThink session. And I remember asking a question about educational game design, like what what kind of educational gaming, something about the future of educational game design. And what Bo said was, students are already living in gamified systems. Mm-hmm. School has been gamified. Social media has been gamified. So the game-like elements have been applied to alter these systems. But these systems are still doing what these systems do. Yeah. So, you know, from my point of view, I imagine many of you would agree that these systems are quite oppressive or can be quite oppressive to young people. So Bo said, you know, maybe one move is actually to support young people in identifying how these systems are gamified and then either de-gamifying them or redesigning the game, right? So that's exactly what we've been doing at this local high school the past couple weeks. We identified various systems, gamified systems. We analyzed them sort of using sort of a high school version of the kind of work that you do, right, as a critical game study scholar. We invited students to think like a game study scholar, right, and analyze these systems. And then we invited them to imagine redesigning them and to build game prototypes that embody what the redesign could look like. And then we went through an iterative design process, very similar to what we do here at USC, of creating these prototypes, play testing them, getting feedback on them, and then creating new versions. And then students reflected on that. And I was very impressed with the games they made. So that gave me some hope, you know, that for the future of gaming in particular, what gaming could be, you know, and just seeing the creativity and brilliance that these young people brought to the table really gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, same, same.
So moving on to the next question here, which is related. So you're working on an upcoming book on The Sims, mm-hmm. Another thing we've done in Radical Play Lab is we've hosted game design challenges focused on simulating actions people can take
right.
to enact social change. We've done that with USC students, for example. What do you think is important about simulations in particular?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How can they reinforce systemic oppression, and how can they support liberation from oppression?
Well, for me, all games are simulations. And so, I mean, because you're playing or working in a context that is a model and is you know, predicated on like systems and processes, whether it's an analog game or whether it's a digital game, you know, for me it's all a simulation. And so it gives you that framework, it gives you that context to work things out or to play, you know, things out. And The Sims is obviously, it's a life simulator, so it doesn't, I don't think it very quickly seems to connect to maybe some of the sort of bigger structural issues in society that we would like to see remodeled and played with and hacked even, because it's, The Sims is a domestic like life simulator. It's about the everydayness of life, and people do, the most people tend to do in The Sims, it seems, is create like drama. And you know, there's cheating stories and the romantic dramas, and they might, I mean, they're a subset of like torturous actions where you might lock a sim in a basement and, you know, watch them starve because there's that dark pleasure that will always come to the surface. But for the most part, you know, if you're thinking of like abolishing capitalism, The Sims, does The Sims allow you to do that, right? Like, does it allow you to tackle those issues? I argue that The Sims is a utopia, and that, yes, on the surface is a capitalist utopia. And very quickly, though, there are some challenges to capitalism, at least especially in the early stages of what The Sims was, right, over the evolution of the franchise. It was always a cheeky critique of capitalism. You know, I think Will Wright has infamously talked about how you have these household objects. Like, part of it is you get a job, you go to work, you sleep, and it's just like the repetitious cycle of daily life. But part of it is also pursuing this capitalist dream of a bigger house and more stuff, and you know, that's sort of one mode of success. But Wright has talked about how the more stuff you acquire, the more that stuff breaks, right? Like you make money and you buy stuff, but your TV is never working, and The Sims need that to be happy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there is a sort of subtle critique of like that capitalist acquisition at the heart of The Sims. But what we know from legacy players like myself, I've been playing The Sims for like 25 years, so since it came out, is that, you know, those systems very quickly become boring and people subvert them, right? They use money cheats, like it's just, your story that you want to tell might have nothing to do with that. So very quickly, money becomes irrelevant. And then, you know, even if you take the game at face value, there is a sort of socially dedicated or socially responsible vision of capitalism at The Sims, where everybody gets a sort of a living wage to begin with, or you get like a stipend to kind of start building your house, right? There's certain social mechanisms that are in place in The Sims that I think make it a kind of more functional, not necessarily a social democracy, but a more functional like economic system, and maybe a more equitable economic system. And then after you play it for a while, you just start subverting that. You start subverting that, and then what we've seen is people build communities that they want to live in, pretend, like, so there's a trend in The Sims 4 of people building like tiny queer communities. And so like the tiny town model has people owning very, very small blueprint houses, you know, so that you can have like a ton of people on a lot because you have a tiny house, not a McMansion. And then, you know, it's populated with people who are diverse, diverse bodies and, you know, orientations and everything. And so I think what's important to me and interesting to me about The Sims, and I know I'm like a little bit off-road in terms of your question, is that at least in that case, people can start to simulate and model the socialities that they want, the immediate local communities that they want to build with. In The Sims 3, I had a whole thing called like the Afro-vegan. Like, The Sims 3 was an open world experience, whereas The Sims 4 is not. But it was, I had this thing where no one had jobs. Everybody just like farmed and worked, and they were all vegan, you know? And they all just like, there was just fruit trees and things, and The Sims would just autonomously go and like pick the fruit, you know? And
I
built up this whole city of people that live that way, and you also didn't have to have cars. Right? You had bikes and things and other means of transportation. So like you could, on a smaller scale than SimCity, you know, start to model like what are the types of communities that you find interesting and you want to be in. And yes, of course, there's always relational drama because like that's the spice of life in The Sims, that that you may have this different structure, but you always have to have some cheating or some, you know, backstabbing neighbor or something going on. And so that's why I am privy to The Sims. But in general, I think, again, games can allow us to model that. Serious games, of course, can. Educational games, serious games can allow us to try out these different structures, play out these different what-if scenarios. But even the most popular, banal-seeming games that we think can't get you there can be co-opted and are often hacked and modded and repurposed in ways that were not intended.
Yeah, that's really fascinating because I'm hearing both sides. I'm hearing it's both oppressive and liberating, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's you know, we gotta be real about that. And I'm thinking about, you know, sort of simulations more broadly, that's also the case, right? So we can say, because we know that simulations and games are such powerful learning environments and media for communication, that doesn't mean that they're automatically used for good, right? They can be used for a range of options. So even futurity and future imagination can be used for a range of options. For example, there are police training centers across the country that are you know, that activists call cop cities, where they basically build playgrounds for police to imagine authoritarian rule in the future and cracking down on protests and that sort of thing. For example, in Atlanta, and they're doing game-based learning. They're doing simulated role play. They're doing all the things that we do, but for their own goals, right? So my friends and I are arguing that social movements need our own versions of that to counter that and to imagine our own futures and practice the skills we need to make them happen. That's what we've been building through an abolitionist gaming network, where we're trying to simulate, you know, the kinds of futures you're talking about building with Afro-vegan. You know, people are imagining that kind of future, queer utopias and things like that. Maybe not even utopia. Maybe there's still problems, but we're at least imagining a way to survive and hopefully thrive in the face of climate change and racism and transphobia and so on.
I really like working with utopia as a term because I think we already know what dystopia is. I think I teach a class called Dystopias. This is the first year I haven't taught that class in like, I don't know, 13 years or something. But we're very familiar with dystopia. In our popular culture, our games, dystopian games, I've argued, in print, is the most common narrative context. We got a lot of dystopias. Our films, you know, we already know what's going to happen because we've imagined it in the dystopian, you know, frame. What we don't know and what we don't have experience with is utopia. We have historically a lot of experience with anti-utopias. So that's the tradition where, you think something is a utopia. The intention was for it to be, hey, this is going to be great, let's get on board here, and then it's a nightmare, right? So that's the anti-utopia, which the goal is to, you know, shatter the possibility of utopia, to criticize it and say it's never going to exist. But I'm really critically interested in lots of different ways of thinking about utopia, right? That it's not paradise, right? It's not maybe this totalizing system of changes that will have consequences and could have some negative consequences depending on what your subject position is, right? Is Elon Musk's utopia the same as mine? Nope, I don't think so. Nope, I'm pretty
definitely
sure.
Not.
I'm pretty sure.
Not
it's
mine
not,
either.
Right? So vantage point is important, right? And yeah. Who's defining and what those changes are that would make it that. But I'm really, really interested in games and design projects that try to approach something like utopia, and but also redefine and sort of take some of the weight off of that concept, because it's been so intimidating and foreboding. Like, I don't want to. I already know, you know, that that probably isn't going to work. So let's talk about what happens when everything crumbles, when the zombies come for us again, when the infected, when the next outbreak happens again. So that's the modality that we've been in. But what I find productive about utopia as a critical space is the reclamation of hope. We need hope, and we need radical hope, right? We need to use our imaginations in a way that pushes us toward something that feels better, right? Better than. What if we take that thunder, steal that thunder from utopia and say, okay, it's not paradise. That's going to be really impossible to achieve, right? Utopia is by its nature impossible, but it's defined as sort of like the better no place, the place that doesn't exist yet that can be better than what we have now. And we don't use our creative energies to do that. And I would love to see more games explicitly take that on. You know, and in my work, I've argued, hey, we haven't really seen a lot of that in game design, but maybe they're utopian mechanics. Like, how do we walk back a little and say, what do we have? And one of my biggest things lately is I think there are utopian mechanics that people sort of settle on that, like, hey, you might be in this really dark dystopian frames. Can I guarantee people in this room are making dystopias right now? You know, you got them. But there might be a mechanic, an activity that is that they've embedded in the game, like meditation or crafting or something, flying and gardening or something that gives a little bit of that light. But what if the context shifts and there's more of that? There's more of that bold, imaginative problem solving and social dreaming in a way that isn't just, man, it's going to be really messed up, right? It's going to be really, really dark and awful. So I really would like us to push the envelope in that regard.
I agree with that. That's something that I've been finding in my research too. One participant from a research study I did, his name is Nathan Lattimore. He gave me permission to share his ideas here. He talked about the game mechanic in Death Stranding being an example of that. Even though it's so dystopian, people can leave things and other people can build on them, and that mechanic is sort of models what we need to imagine and move towards liberated futures. He describes the future as a wall that representing racism and climate change, and society is like a car speeding towards that wall, and we need to swerve away from it. But he argued we're procrastinating because we're constantly inundated with social media, and the personalization algorithms of social media are constantly telling us more information about these problems and how they affect us personally, but they're not giving us chances to collectively and collaboratively prototype ways of doing something about it. So I've been arguing based on my research, for example, like with Nathan, who was part of a Afrofuturist game design series of workshops that we did, and I studied how people learned and imagined during those workshops with colleagues. And you know, we found that the sort of prototopian thinking to be a main part of that, that's what we've been calling it. It's very similar to what you're saying, like this idea of we can, and it's really building on Tracy, on your work as well, on play-centric design, right? The idea that we all can start somewhere. We all can make something. We all can make a prototype of something and get feedback on it from our peers, right? That's the essence of what we do here at USC Games and all of our classes, right? We make prototypes and get feedback. So I'm arguing that we can do the same thing in our social movements. We can do the same thing with our, you know, building the futures we want. We can make a prototype of this kind of society that you're talking about imagining, and we can see what happens when we put it out in the world and start getting feedback on it. We don't have to wait to start. We don't have to wait to be the perfect activist or the perfect game designer, right? We can all start right now.
I love that metaphor of the swerve. Like, you're headed toward this wall. What does just a little swerve look like, right? Not necessarily like redesigning the map so that the wall is not even there, right? Because we all know we're headed toward that wall. But what does just a small maneuver even look like? And what does that feel like to sort of play in that? You know, I think that's those are the things that I really want to see us try more often. By all means, redesign the map so that the wall's not there. But let's see what that action, that mechanic is that gets us to veer off and explore that small slice of it. Because I know it's pretty intimidating for folks to tackle, you know, all the systemic issues that might have to be changed to make a utopia in the first place.
So that's a good note to turn it over now to the audience for question and answer. We're thinking about, you know, what can we all do, right? That's a good sort of spirit to approach this discussion in. I'm curious what you all think. Questions, comments, visions of the future?
Question?
Should I come over?
Yeah.
I can start. So, to bring up earlier, Professor Russell.
Maybe introduce yourself.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Quick intro. Hi, my name is Kevin. I am a junior here at USC studying CS games. And I had a question for Professor Russell. Earlier, you mentioned how you talked about sort of Sims being a system that we model and sort of play within, but you also talked about sort of the limitations of modeling real life is hard, and I don't think we'll ever reach the point of being able to entirely model it. That being said, there is still something to be said about having like a small chunk of vertical slice of life and sort of enjoying what's within that vertical slice. Mm-hmm. So that brings me to my next question of, or to my question of, in our pursuit to sort of model these real world systems, I'm curious, especially with the development of recent technology, specifically with regards to generative AI, mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on using these kind of technologies to broaden that scope in terms of these systems we can model? And then on top of that, is there a valid ethical concern in terms of allowing these AIs to autonomously perform certain behaviors, especially when they could be trained on potentially biased data?
Thank you.
Okay. So I think you answered your question very well, and I'm just going to tease out kind of what I hear, you know, embedded there. Is there, because this is a larger question and conversation about generative AI and design and systemic, you know, logics and simulations and the role of these tools now and especially in the future. And it always makes me cautious, right? I think that removing sort of human agency from any of these equations is going to is going to create some new risk and some new challenges. But from what I'm learning from my students, and in fact, last night in my one of my graduate class, we just had a conversation about this, and actually people were informing me, because I'm not a designer, how AI, generative AI, is being used right now in animation and various phases of the production process and sound design. I mean, it's really eye-opening. And so on the one hand, I don't feel like I can speak with any real specificity about that, those corners and those nooks and corners of game design, but it seems like a tool that is going to be around, like a set of tools that is going to be around for a while, and might be used to productive end, is currently being used to productive end. And so I have a curiosity there, but also there's the cautionary side of hey, you're using image sourcing, even like the biases embedded in that, and the source material that you're getting and how that's navigated. There are a lot of potentially thorny drawbacks to that that we've already seen replicated in our uptick of new technologies historically anyway, right? That often an uptick in new technology leads to greater dehumanization, and most often to the most marginalized subjects in society, right? That's been par for the course forever. So that is my pause there. But are those tools interesting? Could those tools be useful in certain contexts? I think the answer is, yeah, probably. People are using them now, right? But I think there are lots of questions about the ethics of those choices and the over-reliance on that, and then how they're used in a specific case-by-case basis. And then the bigger concern about where are the people making these decisions. And not just anybody. I mean, I think that where are the people that have the kind of ethical grounding and concerns that can make make important moves and interventions in that space as well. So I wouldn't say that every single person in the room is going to make the right decisions and flag things that are a problem, but having people that have that training and have that orientation to challenge in the first place is what's most important. And I definitely don't trust AI to do it for us.
Hi, I'm Brian. I'm a second-year grad student who's also a game and narrative designer. Thank you both for your excellent conversation. I'm just wondering, there is a certain group of gamers that feel like commercial games should be devoid of any political message or social message as well. And I'm just wondering, do you feel like there's anything within the game's design or narrative that might convince them otherwise?
Convince them otherwise, sure. Well, I sort of think that's our job as educators, as society, as an informed society, to begin with the impossibility of removing politics from anything, right? That it's all political. And especially commercial games, you know. I talked about Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, which I'm looking forward to Grand Theft Auto 6. Like, it's one of my top franchises to play. I like a lot of things about Grand Theft Auto's open world experience. I like its satire, but I'm also very aware of what it is. As a famous game studies book, Games of Empire, you know, encourage us to see how these are tools of empire. So I think that's the first, the starting place though, right? Is that often in the public discourse, politics is a showstopper. The discussion of politics in an overt way is, you know, people shut down or they get to their quickly to their reactionary positions. And what I think we need more than ever right now is a way to have dialogue that is more open and more generative, but we have no practice with in the popular sense, right? Social media, the back and forth position, the tweet does not allow for real discussion. And I think that it's a lost art, or an art that is never fully formed. And I think we need to create those spaces. One question I ask my students a lot as they're doing their final projects now is, what's the after effect? What's the afterlife of your project, right? So you're in this space, you're doing this work, you're playing with this. Where do you see the discourse ever happening? Is there a need for that, right? Because the material object can get us to a certain place and can have us think about these things. But often, to really cash in on what people have experienced in your work, you need another mechanism, right? You might need a follow-up, or you might need, I'm not talking about a sequel, you might need another way for discourse to happen, for that imagination to continue in a safe space. And it might not be talking, right? It might not be what I'm most comfortable with and used to, is sitting and talking. I think that might have to happen at some point, but maybe there's something that I'm not thinking about, another way to get people to continue to move the needle on what real open exploration of arguments and ideas looks like and sounds like and feels like. And we have none of that in our popular political sphere at all, right? So I think oftentimes when people have that reaction that keep politics out of my game, you know, they often mean the politics that offends them, and that's it, right? But yeah, that's a big detrimental problem that we have to face. And I'm interested in thinking of ways, like, I don't know if you have ideas, how do we get there, right? Because you get someone intrigued in the game. And I think this is why commercial games, I don't shut them out. I say, they're a part of it, let's play Call of Duty, if that's what we need to do. I'm terrible at it. I cannot shoot, I can't play first-person shooters very well. But if that's the space that we have to be in to talk about something and you can actually hear me, then let's try it. And I don't know that it's online playing either. I don't think that discourse often happens there and those maps necessarily, the kind that I'm talking about, thinking about where I would enter, but maybe it's just playing in a room together. You know, like originally with Radical Play, we just met with kids after school and played games with them and talked about the things that they were interested in that were facing their community. And maybe that's the small scale version of how do you really have real conversation where you're not so threatened that you're shutting down.
I wonder if it's possible to design a sort of conscious or a intentional critical form of escapism. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think some people say that they don't want politics in their games because they want their games to be an escape from politics. They're tired. They're overwhelmed by politics. They feel like the political system is failing, or just a mess or whatever, right? And they want something different. I'm thinking about, for example, Kashana Gray's research on Black gamers and after 2014, after Ferguson, how sometimes they were trying to take a break from, being involved in Black Lives Matter protests or talking about police brutality. They just wanted a space to just decompress. But then, as they were playing these games, and sometimes it was even mainstream games, but like you were describing earlier, they created these spaces of discourse where they ended up talking about politics anyway. But it was kind of a way of doing it in this like rest space, where like the rest space was like a way to recharge and get ready to then go and do something. So they weren't saying like, oh, don't say Black Lives Matter. I mean, they were supportive of the protests, right, that were happening, but they were taking a break and critically reflecting, mm-hmm. and then getting ready to go back and do something that was highly political, right? And that's a, you know, I'm thinking about, we could even go, could even think about what is escape? I mean, when I think of escape, I think of the history of, you know, people, enslaved people escaping from slavery, right? I think of the Maroon communities, which were kind of where these utopian or prototopian communities, right, where they created forms of politics that were, you know, where everybody was self-governing. There was no hierarchy, right? And, you know, I'm thinking about, like, C.L.R. James wrote a lot about that. You know, he's the great, great sort of Pan-African thinker and liberation thinker. And I sometimes wonder, what if our analyses of play came from C.L.R. James instead of like these European anthropologists who are sort of the founders of so-called quote-unquote founders of game studies? What if we looked at his perspective on play, where he said through play people learn to be self-governing, right? People learn, he said he described ancient Greek direct democracy like it was a rap battle, you know, whoever gets the most applause gets to go on to the next stage and say the next thing, and you know, so it's playful, right? And he argued that those kind of dynamics were there in the Black Liberation Movement as well. So even when people are trying to escape and play, there's something political about that, you know. And that's I wonder if we can design intentionally. For example, somebody else from another participant in the Critical Game Jam I mentioned earlier, the Afrofuturist Game Jam I mentioned earlier, Brianna Mims is making a game called Marooning Bodies, which very intentionally tries to do this, right? Imagining a maroon community, imagining a liberated community without police and prisons, and creating a playful welcoming ritual for people into that community, right? Like a dances and things like that. She's playtested inside of prisons and all over the US and all over the African continent and Morocco, Ghana, and other places. So, you know, this game is, it's imaginative. In a way, it's escapist, but it's not apolitical. It's about challenging white supremacy, right? But it's about doing that in a very imaginative, playful way that also allows for rest and spaciousness and things like that.
I hope you don't mind if I jump on it, this question, because I think it's a really good question. And this is Tracy, by the way. One of the things that occurs to me is that by saying I don't want politics in my game, you're expecting a level of discourse that's very high, because you have to start with, do I want ideas in my game? Before you can discuss, do I want politics in my game? First, we have to understand that games have ideas in them, and we have to normalize the process by which we extract ideas, by which we generate ideas as we play, right? So you can't have politics that are understandable in a game, which, like you're saying, you know, people aren't recognizing that there already are politics in right. games. They're not recognizing because they're not recognizing that there are ideas in games. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wanted to jump in is because that is actually what the book that I just co-authored is
directly about. So the well-read game On Playing Thoughtfully, which literally just came out yesterday, co-authored
Congratulations, with Matthew Farber,
is about not just literacy in games. Literacy, it's about games as literature. Games as texts, which we need to actually train ourselves to be readers of. We can't just expect people to jump on the idea that, you know, games should be political or not political if they haven't been trained the way you are trained to read books and find ideas in them. If they haven't been trained to be people who understand games as having ideas within them.
Yeah.
Right? And so we're kind of expecting a lot of people to jump from I play games to I'm a political scholar of games.
Right.
It's a lot. Yeah. It's a there's you need a bridge from I play games to I understand the ideas within the games to I can critique the ideas that I am provoked to think about when I play games to okay, I like these ideas, I don't like these ideas. Oh, I can read a game that I don't like, that's okay. I can read with a game or against a game, and it's actually okay that I don't agree with everything in a game, right? So this is like a bridge. And what I'm, you know, what the big argument in our book is that basically we have to take those steps. There are baby steps to becoming literate and to becoming, you know, someone who can read literature versus someone who can just read words.
I love it, and I can't wait for the book for you to get signed my copy, which I will bring to you. But it's powerful. That's where I think games have the biggest potential, is if we can get people, to use your term, reading the game. If we can get people reading the worlds. And they already are, but we have to get them to see that they are.
That
you're reading it, because I remember Mafia 3, which is a game that's set in the 60s. You play as a black character who is in the like South in the 60s, supposed to be like Louisiana. And so there's like hardwired discrimination and racism in the game. But when you go into certain neighborhoods as that character, the police have an immediate response. Like, you can't even walk into the store because of segregation, right? And then people are afraid. The AI, the passerby, the bystanders are afraid of you just showing up in, you know, the downtown area, the wealthy areas of the city. And so you instantly get a police response just from showing up there. And players commenting on that immediately, right, saying that this is because it's trying to represent this moment in history. And so there's already like dialogue kind of happening around those choices to try to represent this historical moment in reality. And so there you go. People are reading the codes in the game, the systems.
I don't know if you've played Life is Strange 2, but there's this great moment where the two Hispanic boys walk into the store, and some of the choices you're given are whether or not to shoplift or not, right? You know, whether or not I should steal some, you know, rice or candy because we are on the road and we don't have any money, right? But we're in this store, and there's like a white woman at the at the register. There's another guy sort of sitting there. You're like, okay, do I need this stuff enough to steal it?
Right.
Or should I not steal it?
Yeah.
Interestingly, this game, which is not an open world, funnels you down, which I always have been so slightly disappointed, because whether you steal or not, you get accused of stealing. And I think the game is saying something very specific with that, right? You know, I always was like, oh, you know, I wish it didn't funnel down to that, because I should, you know, be able to choose. But of course, there's an authorial choice that no matter whether you steal and whether you deserve it or not, you're going to get accused of stealing. Do we have other questions? I don't mean to jump all over.
No, this is great. Because my question, Tracy, is how do we get, and how do we continue that? How do we get the reading process, you know, at the heart of what we do?
We
read your book. We read your book. Okay. All right. I'm going to read the book, and then I'll come back.
Hi. Hopefully this question is maybe at least tangentially.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Hi. Moss Dooley. I'm a third year MFA student in the games program. Really, really insightful talk so far. I took far more notes than I was expecting to take. So yeah, hopefully this question is kind of tangentially related to how we get players to where we want them to be in terms of thinking about games critically. Two things that really stood out to me with what you guys were talking about was you said kind of looking at Sims as a case study of when money ceases to have any meaning, mm-hmm. And the kind of range of play styles or things that players do under these circumstances and how that changes. Like you said that you started this kind of radical or very relaxed, casual, radical, black, vegan POC community. But I think the far more common case that we see is people like locking their Sims in a basement.
Yes.
It is like a lot more chaotic, a lot more dark, even to a satirical point, but still dark. So, and then connecting that with later what you guys were saying in terms of creating utopian play and creating utopia as a critical space for play. My question is, how do you teach players in a community that's so ready to kind of jump into the dark side and immediately make those assumptions?
For sure.
How do you teach them or tutorialize or encourage players to give utopia a chance?
It's a great question. Yeah.
Love it so much. Okay, so the basement thing with the Sims and starving your Sims and killing them off, you know, that is not what ultimately motivates Sims players, right? People do it because you can, and there's always this fascination with breaking the game or pushing the moral code or the logics, testing the boundaries in any context. That's going to happen. People want to know, if I go here, can I swim or am I going to drown, right? Like, they want to test out that. And what I think I've found in The Sims, especially studying The Sims for such a long time, it is a great case study because you have people who've been playing it for 25 years, 20 years, 15 years. I have my students who say, oh, yeah, I played The Sims when I was like in junior high school, right? And that's always the case that people will go to the torture side of things, the dark play. They'll try it out. But actually, it doesn't keep them playing the game. You know, the people that play The Sims for 25 years, 20 years, are not doing that anymore. They might have sessions where that happens, and they're like, oh my God, that Sim across the street was really annoying, so we trapped her in the basement. But ultimately, I think what drives them is something higher. It's something more curious. It's something relational. It's something that they're curious about, or they want to, you know, practice, whether it's the family dynamics or whether it's the creativity. Like, there's a lot of like crafting and creative hobbies and things, you know. And then The Sims is always, because its economic model is what it is, there's always an expansion pack that adds another layer or another set of systems that you can unlock and explore. Those are the things that keep people playing. So I guess that tells me that once you've explored the darker side, right, that dystopian turn, which we unfortunately seem to be in our media culture, our visual culture, no matter what, that is where we are. You know, in our film culture, our games, we are in dystopias. Normally, once you pass that out, like once you get through that in The Sims, it's not the thing that keeps you there, right? You want to actually explore other stuff and you want to create. So that's exciting to me. Breaking the game, testing the boundaries, that's par for the course. We will do that, but it's not the thing that keeps you playing.
I also wonder if maybe modding is a way to, you know, there's maybe ways to mod games and ways that build on that desire to test and break the game, but then actually mod the game in a way that opens up liberatory potentials, mm-hmm. right? Like people modding The Sims, for example, for Black Lives Matter protests. Or we've done modding sessions in Radical Play where we've modded existing games about sustainability. We've modded them to have more of an anti-racist focus, and we found that people's motivation to take climate action went up after they modded. So that might be a way forward. Mm-hmm. Do we have time for one more question?
Do we have one more question?
Well, this has been one of the best playthings recently that I can remember.
Yay!
So let's wrap this up.
Well, yes, thank you. I should be on mic and just thank everyone for such a wonderful conversation. And yes, let's give them one more hand.
Thank you so much for having us, Tracy and everybody. Thank you for having us here. This was a great discussion. It was wonderful talking with you, talking with everyone.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.